Welcome back to Interventions, the intellectual history podcast. My name is Zach Raveld.
And I'm Elena Zen.
Together with Michael Namira, I'm excited to be one of the new hosts of the podcast this year. For this episode, I'll be joined by Elena, whose PhD is on the politics of belief in Hume and Enlightenment skepticism. Her work has been published in History of European Ideas and the International Journal of Philosophical Studies. Thank you for joining me today, Elena.
Thank you, Zach. So our guest today is Professor James Harris. James is a professor of philosophy and head of the School of Philosophical, Anthropological and Film Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He's also the co-director of the Institute of Intellectual History there.
James studied English and philosophy at Oxford and the New School for Social Research in New York. He returned to Oxford for his DPhil, supervised by Galen Strawson and Ralph Walker. James is best known for his research on Hume, among other 18th century thinkers, and also writes extensively on early modern political thought. His most notable publications include Of Liberty and Necessity, The Free Will Debate in 18th Century British Philosophy, with Oxford in 2005, co-editing two volumes of Scottish Philosophy in the 18th Century, again with Oxford in 2015 and 2023, and perhaps most notably, Hume, an Intellectual Biography, with Cambridge in 2015. James was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh in 2019. Thank you for joining us today, James.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
You began your career, as you said, as a philosopher interested in free will. Your first monograph, Of Liberty and Necessity, The Free Will Debate in 18th Century British Philosophy, examined this debate from John Locke to Dugald Stewart. How has this shaped your research of David Hume in particular?
Well, in the sense that looking at that debate got me interested in the particular approach to the free will problem that was characteristic of 18th century British philosophy, which is pretty different to how philosophers treat the question now. So they were not, as I thought, they were not treating the problem as a problem of metaphysics or purely of moral philosophy, but as in Lockean spirit, as an empirical question to be answered in empirical fashion. So that's what I was trying to do in my PhD thesis, was try to bring out what was distinctive of the 18th century British approach to a perennial philosophical question. And of course, part of that project was to try and bring out what was distinctive of Hume's particular take on the question. So it became obvious to me that Hume was not a compatibilist in the sense in which philosophers tend to use that term now. He wasn't a compatibilist because he wasn't a determinist. So I was trying to bring out what was, Hume's own particular understanding of the doctrine of philosophical necessity, understand it in relation to previous versions of that doctrine, as a way of showing how Hume thought he was, as he put it himself, putting a new light on the controversy.
I think I would just add and follow up, because when you were talking about Hume's particularity, did you start to reflect on what kind of approach, or what kind of specifically like contextualism or more sort of intellectual history's way of doing things come into your research?
Yes, absolutely. Because I was, I was tracing this debate through the 18th century. So I was quite keenly aware of how philosophers had approached the question up until the point where Hume did something very, very different. So I was trying to understand Hume's intervention by contrasting it with much more kind of metaphysically orientated treatments of the problem earlier on in the 18th century. So my goal was to do justice to Hume's skepticism about metaphysics, whilst at the same time seeing him as making a distinctive kind of contribution to the free will question, which was, of course, traditionally seen as a metaphysical question.
And how did you move on from being interested in Hume on free will to being more widely interested in Hume and his wider philosophy?
It became very important to me to try and make sense of what Hume was doing on his own terms, to do justice to his own understanding of his philosophical project. And I became increasingly sure that that Hume's understanding of his project was pretty different to how later Anglophone philosophers had interpreted Hume. There was this desire to understand Hume on his own terms that I guess took me away from history of philosophy as it's sort of standardly done in the Anglophone world and towards something more recognizable as intellectual history, I suppose.
I think this is a good point to talk about your most well-known work. So let's move on to Hume and intellectual biography. Taking Hume as a man of letters is the key point in your book. So our listeners would be interested to know, why did you choose to interpret Hume's thought in this way?
Well, because that's how he thought of himself. So it was sort of directly continuous. I mean, with the earlier work that I'd done, it was just, again, trying to understand Hume in his own terms. And at least my contention in the book is that that is how Hume thought of himself. And that if we're trying to find a way of seeing Hume's intellectual career as a whole, that that's the key to see him as applying the methods and literary style and so forth of a man of letters to a range of, you know, really quite different questions. And if we do want to try, and as of course was my remit as an intellectual biographer, trying to find some way of giving order and structure to Hume's career, that seemed to me to be the way to do it.
Do you think you could apply this approach to other 18th century thinkers?
Well, some. I mean, insofar as some of them, like Hume, thought of themselves as men of letters and took that to be a quite specific kind of role, if you like, in intellectual culture, a quite specific kind of intellectual kind of posture, if you like. So I'm sure you could, if you knew a lot more about Voltaire, for example, than I do, that might be a way of approaching somebody like Voltaire. But equally, possibly Samuel Johnson or Horace Walpole, or, you know, there's a number of different figures who I think had a similar kind of self-understanding to Hume. They had different interests, of course, and different kind of some very pretty different fundamental assumptions. But I think it was a wider project for authors in the 18th century. And by which I mean that they were quite self-consciously trying to do something a bit different from what had been done before. And they were trying to move intellectual activity out of the universities, trying to make it less arcane and less dry and less scholastic, to bring it into the public sphere and to make it more appealing to as wide an audience as possible. And I think this persona of the man of letters, or the person of letters, was a kind of vehicle that enabled that different people could, as it were, drive in different directions and do different things with. So yeah, definitely.
My point was a broader point, taking the approach that intellectuals might see themselves in a particular way. Smith, for example, may have seen himself as a teacher. Mm. To what extent adopting that and realizing that, can that help shape our reading of his philosophy, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a very nice contrast, in fact, because I think there's one thing that Hume didn't think of himself as. It was precisely as a teacher. So as I understand Hume's career, he wasn't deeply disappointed by the fact that he failed to become a university teacher, because I just don't think that was his kind of métier. That wasn't his self-conception. I mean, it would have given him a job and an income and a place in Scottish society and so forth. But I don't think in his heart of hearts he was a teacher. He didn't want to tell young boys, because it was young boys we're talking about here, you know, people in their early teens, you know, how to live their lives. That just wasn't what he was about. Smith, by contrast, I think probably was, in a very deep sense, a teacher, at least in the early part of his career. And I think that has to be, you know, where you begin in understanding his moral philosophy and theory of moral sentiments in particular, which, you know, begins in his teaching, arises out of his lecturing at Glasgow. And there's a kind of didacticism, I mean, a subtle kind of didacticism, but a concern for how life is lived, for the character of virtue and how virtue is instilled. There's a concern for all those things in Smith, which there really isn't in Hume. So I think, yes, of course, there are other roles, other personae that 18th century intellectuals could adopt. you know, there wasn't that there was the man of letters or nothing. For some intellectuals, I mean, you might think of Kant, for example, you know, that the persona of the university teacher was absolutely integral to what they were about. So, yes.
So this approach of interpreting Hume as a man of letter could have some, as it were, trade-off. For example, it takes A Treatise of Human Nature as one of Hume's many works throughout his career, rather than the most important one. So what can this tell us about how philosophers and historians should treat the classics and canons?
Well, it tells us that they do treat philosophers and canons in different ways. It seems to me that any kind of properly historical understanding of Hume's career has to accept the fact that the treatise was an early work that Hume became disenchanted with or felt disappointed by. Anyway, he left it behind and moved on and doesn't seem to have felt much regret about that, moved on to other things. And approached, well, some of the same questions stayed with him, but he treated them in very different ways in later texts. And I don't see that as, in any sense, like a compromise or a watering down of the message or something that Hume felt that he had to do in order to avoid the religious authorities of the day or anything like that. It was just like part of a natural progression of his thinking, I think. Whereas I think the philosopher, or many philosophers that I know anyway, are just a bit disappointed with Hume, that they're disappointed that he abandoned and disowned the treatise. They think it's obvious that the treatise is his most important work, where his most important philosophical thinking is done, and you know that's the real Hume, and everything else is in some sense second best. Not everybody thinks that, of course, but I think I would say that is still the majority view. Why do philosophers think that? Well, because there's a way of reading the treatise. And there's a historical story to be told about why that's the case. But there's a way of treating the treatise which is sees its questions as still central to the subject of philosophy now, that it's in the treatise that Hume kind of makes a case for himself as a perennial philosophical thinker who is still part of a conversation that we're having today. So not all of the treatise fits that bill, and some of it has to be sort of cut out and forgotten about. But a lot of it does speak to the concerns of today's philosophers. So yes, I mean, I think philosophers and historians are kind of bound to approach this particular question differently, and therefore bound to have different views, I suppose, of the book that I wrote about Hume.
I have a question about the approach you take with an intellectual biography. To what extent do you think that is a more useful tool or approach to take to understand 18th century thinkers or thinkers more widely than taking the approach you used in your first book, which was much more about a debate, the free will debate, and different interventions in that debate?
Well, I mean, an intellectual biography is just a particular kind of project, and I was asked to take on this project. It had been offered in the first instance to three, in fact, quite eminent Hume scholars who were supposedly writing the book as a team. And perhaps unsurprisingly, that hadn't really worked out. And they looked to somebody who might make a bit less of a meal of doing it. But I don't think it is a more useful tool. I mean, I don't think that if I was beginning again with the free will problem in the 18th century, I don't believe it would be very useful to approach that as a kind of intellectual biographical kind of problem. It's just not that kind of problem. I was given the opportunity, and it was a privilege really, to be asked to do this thing about Hume. And it was, I didn't take it up because I was sort of dissatisfied with what I'd done before. It was just a different kind of challenge. I mean, I would say that different intellectual figures require different kinds of intellectual biographies, and writing an intellectual biography of Hume was both easy and not easy at the same time. And it was easy because that is for Hume, that isn't very much of the basic biographical material that an intellectual biographer kind of would hope to find in order to begin to work up a story. So there weren't years and years of work to be done with the diaries and the notebooks and the letters and so forth, because basically just none of that survived. So in a sense, it was easier to get going. Of course, then On the other hand, it makes it much harder because you're just speculating most of the time. So it's very hard to know whether the story you're telling is really one that the subject, in this case Hume himself, would have recognized as a good story told about him. I don't know.
Let's move on to a recent book you published, which, quite contrary to the enormous length of human intellectual biography, is extremely short, namely the Oxford Very Short Introduction to David Hume. Most likely, this will be your shortest, potentially broadest, and yet also most read work. How do you say something interesting without losing the non-expert audience?
That's a good question. And it's absolutely right to say that it was the non-expert audience that I had in mind writing that book. And the circumstances of writing it kind of helped to that end, because I wrote it during the first COVID lockdown when I didn't have very many books at my disposal, nor much time. And I just kind of sat down and wrote, really. I mean, like planning a bit, obviously, but it wasn't a deeply researched book, partly, of course, because I had done a lot of research before. I have a number of things to say about that. I mean, I think the first thing is not to underestimate the non-expert reader. And so I don't think things need to be dumbed down, watered down very much in a book like that. But I think that the most successful books in that kind of vein are books which, if you like, don't try to say too many things, which books which have a kind of a one theme or one angle or one argument and try to explore that in a reasonably thorough way over 25, 30,000 words, and to try and keep things kind of unified and not too diverse and confusing. So that was what I was trying to do. So I took basically the narrative and some, not all of the ideas, and I changed my ideas about a few things of my intellectual biography, and just tried to kind of pare it down to the essence, really, and just try to communicate as clearly as I could the heart of how I saw Hume as a man of letters, and that remained my theme. But it was, I hope, it was a much clearer and less kind of baroque kind of book that I worked there. Obviously I read a lot of other very short introductions as a way of preparing to write that book, and it seemed to me that the most successful ones are the ones which just have had one idea or perhaps a couple of ideas and used that as a way of introducing a thinker of the past. So that's what I was trying to do there. All the time working on that book, I had in mind the previous very short introduction to Hume by A.J. Eyre. I was very consciously trying, as it were, to write the opposite kind of book, a book directly contrary in its ambitions. I mean, Eyre's book is, just to go back to what I was saying about the treatise and so forth, you know, it's about how Hume is relevant to the philosophy of the 20th century as Eyre understood it. In fact, in many, many ways, that very short introduction is a kind of very short introduction to A.J. Eyre's understanding what philosophy ought to be about. Well, there needed to be a different kind of book, which was much less partisan and much less open, much more open-minded about what Hume's philosophy was about. So Eyre's book, you know, has a chapter on personal identity and an external world and causation and so forth, and then has one final, the shortest chapter, which is on morality, politics, and religion. So all of that is, you know, which obviously Hume spent most of his life writing about, all of that is compressed into a short final chapter. And it just seemed obvious to me that something very, very different was needed as a way of really bringing Hume alive for the non-expert audience today, you know, to bring out the breadth of Hume's interest and how many different kinds of questions he has something to say about.
Yeah, the contrast between your version and Eyre's version was also something that surprised me a lot. I suppose that also reflects the development of philosophy as a discipline throughout all these decades.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. So I remember one of the readers that OUP hired to look at my manuscript commented that I didn't use the word empiricism anywhere in the text. And he was kind of struck by this and really thought that it was a mistake, because I was kind of abstracting Hume from his kind of place in the history of philosophy. And he's right. I mean, I absolutely was doing that. And it was a very conscious decision that I wanted to put Hume back in the 18th century and leave him there when, of course, the word empiricism hadn't actually been invented yet. So this was, again, another aspect of my kind of general interest in seeing thinkers, how they saw themselves, rather than trying to force our labels and agendas onto them.
Okay, so moving away from Hume, at today's political thought seminar, you are giving a paper on Hobbes' concept of the people. Could you just briefly introduce your paper and how it connects with your research on early modern debates over political obligation?
Let me begin with the second part of your question then. So I've done a bit of work on what you could think of as the sort of afterlife of the debate between Locke and Filmer. So I got interested in this because I suppose, like everybody else, maybe not everybody else, but like many other people, I had assumed that, you know, Locke had sort of killed off Filmer, and that it was obviously like a knockout blow from Locke landed on Filmer's kind of political theory. I realized that it was a lot more complicated than that, and that, well, firstly, that Filmer's thought was a bit more sophisticated than I'd realized, but also that people carried on thinking about politics in a Filmerian kind of way for a rather long time after Filmer. I mean, through the 18th century, in fact, you get, I mean, these people don't think of themselves as Filmerians. Maybe they've never read Filmer, and they're certainly quite wary of citing Filmer, but nevertheless, they reject the idea that political authority comes from below, as it were, and are very, very skeptical about most aspects of Locke's political thinking. So I became interested in that and sort of traced the continuation of the debate for about 100 years or so after Locke and Filmer. So that was an argument between those who think of political power and authority as coming from the people and those who think of it as coming from God, perhaps via paternal models of authority. So there's that connection. So the next question to ask is, well, what does somebody mean when they talk about political power as coming from the people? And there are several questions to ask about that, but one of them is, well, what is this thing, the people? Who counts as a member of it? How is it constituted? How is it different from other social groupings? How does one people differ from another, differentiate itself from another people, and so forth? So that's, I guess, how you could see the relationship between those two projects. And I'm still interested in the kind of Locke v. Filmer question, if you like, and in the continuation of Filmerian political thinking, because I think that there are ways in which people who you might not think of as having any kind of sympathy at all for Filmer, like Hume and Smith, can be seen as having at least affinities with aspects of that way of kind of anti-Lockean, this kind of enemy's enemy is my friend sort of way of thinking about political thought, I suppose. But so I think there's more to say about the afterlife of Filmerianism. But yes, but that's the connection between the two things. You asked about the paper itself. Well, the paper is an attempt to bring out what's distinctive of Hobbes's way of thinking about the people, which is, I think, a neglected issue in Hobbes' scholarship, mostly because it's something which is much more prominent in Hobbes's earlier political texts, The Elements of Law and De Cive, not so much in Leviathan. So many books on Hobbes's political thought say nothing at all about this. And I was teaching De Cive at the time of the kind of post-Brexit debates about parliamentary sovereignty and how Parliament stood vis-a-vis the results of the referendum and whether invoking parliamentary procedure was in some sense obstructing the will of the people and so forth. So at that time, you know, our political discourse was sort of saturated with appeals to the people. And it just seemed to me that Hobbes had a very interesting response to the language of populism, and I kind of looked around for literature on it and found that there wasn't very much. So I've been trying to kind of explain it and bring out what I think is distinctive about it in various papers and things, and this is kind of my latest attempt to do that.
On this point, you just mentioned the Brexit referendum and how it sparked your interest in the people and philosophical conceptions of the people. How do you see the relationship between modern politics and political concepts in the history of thought more generally? And do you think modern politics and our problems today can inspire new approaches or new views on the history of philosophy or history of thought?
Well, I suppose as our political problems change, different bits of the past become more or less relevant, and we find resources to help us perhaps not so much understand them, but as to kind of understand our questions a bit better. And we find ways of refreshing our political vocabulary by returning to the past and listening to what it has to tell us, or listening to the questions that it's asking. I think there is a connection. I wouldn't want to be too, you know, insistent on it. And I certainly don't think that, you know, the history of political thought should be driven by present day politics or anything like that. But I think that, you know, why not let the past be interesting to us when it is interesting to us in light of the present day political predicaments? And I really do think that Hobbes has something to say in answer to populist invocations of the people, and I would be happy if kind of Hobbesian kind of replies to populism became a bit more, you know, prominent in our kind of political discourse than they are, because I think it's an important counterweight to cruder versions of populism. A bit of digging has revealed, preliminary digging, I should say, has revealed that, you know, there was quite a long prehistory prior to Hobbes of people trying to figure out what the people was and how to differentiate the people from people considered as a kind of organized political entity, a kind of body politic, from disorganized political groupings, and what turned a kind of loose collectivity of individuals into something recognizable as a people, something which could be seen as a single thing with a single will and so forth. So Hobbes approaches that question in a distinctive kind of way by arguing that what unifies a multitude or a crowd is, well, to put it very simply and quickly and directly, is the will of the sovereign. So insofar as people have submitted to a sovereign, or submitted to an individual, and as it were, made them sovereign by submitting to them, they, as it were, give their wills to the sovereign and allow the sovereign to act for them and speak for them. And that is, as Hobbes sees it, a means whereby a multitude is unified, given a single will, because its single will is now the single will of the sovereign, who might be a single person or a council or something. So it's only, as it were, in the will of the sovereign that a multitude exists as a people. So there's no naturally existing political grouping called a people. And there's no sense, for example, in which the original contract or covenant is a contract made by the people with the sovereign. On the contrary, it's individuals who are party to that contract. And in making the contract and creating sovereign power, they at the same time create a people. They kind of, or they change their mode of existence from multitude into people. But they exist as a people insofar as the sovereign speaks and acts for them. So what this means is, in sort of practical political terms, is that, and Hobbes is obviously very keen on drawing this moral from this, is that there's no challenge to be made to the sovereign on the part of the people. That's kind of nonsensical, because the multitude only exists as a people, to repeat, in the will of the sovereign. So individuals can challenge the sovereign, groups, factions, whatever can challenge the sovereign, but the people can't. So no rebellion or act of resistance can sort of dignify itself with the self-description of a popular revolt or an act of the people. I mean, that's really Hobbes's point, is that you can't legitimate resistance by claiming that it's an act of on the part of the people. It never is, and it simply can't be. The very idea embodies a confusion, according to Hobbes.
Last year, you gave the British Society for the History of Philosophy annual lecture on the question of how a history of the philosophy of 18th century Britain should be written, which has also been published in the British Journal for the History of Philosophy. Given that you've been working at the intersection of philosophy and the history of political thought, how can we bring these fields into collaboration, and what can they learn from each other?
That lecture and the paper and that larger project is, again, an attempt to, if you like, trying to broaden out the Hume project So there I was trying to understand Hume in his own terms, in terms appropriate to his time and place. And this is broadening, as it were, bringing the camera back out and trying to understand, I mean, it's an absurdly ambitious project in a way, but trying to understand 18th century British philosophy in its own terms. And the reason why I'm doing that is because quite a long, an embarrassingly long time ago, I was given a contract by Oxford University Press to write to contribute to a new series of volumes on the history of philosophy. And they asked me to write the one on 18th century British philosophy. For quite a long time, I've been thinking about how even to begin on that project. And in a sense, that lecture was a tentative beginning on the project and really just an opening up of the question. And it was me sort of telling myself really just how difficult a question that is, trying to get clear about what people who wrote texts that described themselves as philosophical texts in the 18th century, what they were doing. What did it mean to think of yourself as a philosopher? Why would you call your inquiry into geology or chemistry or indeed human nature? Why would you call it philosophical? What the sort of connotations of that were and so forth. So that's what I was trying to do there. So it's a particular understanding of the history of philosophy. I've come to think that there are simply many ways of doing the history of philosophy, and there's a spectrum, if you like, of views. I mean, this is nothing deep or original, and some are more historical and some are more philosophical. I don't have any views about which is right or wrong. I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. There are just different ways of doing it, and my way has become, I suppose, quite historical. And so it might very well be that many philosophers, in fact, many even historians of philosophy, will read the book that, God willing, I end up writing one day about this and think, well, that's not really speaking to me. That's just not really, there's not very much about Berkeley in this book, and there's not very much about Hume. And that probably is the kind of book it will be. It will be a bit disappointing to philosophers, because I think in the end you have to make a choice about how you approach these things. You can't do both things at once. And philosophers, even historians of philosophy, just basically what they want is a bit like what my supervisor Galen Strawson wanted. They want to know what they can learn from the past for the purposes of advancing philosophical debate right now. I mean, they may not always be explicit about that, but I think very often that is what's wanted. And of course, that drives our teaching in philosophy departments. I teach in a philosophy department, and that is how we teach. I mean, it's not history for history's sake. So the book I write is not going to be very useful for that purpose. It's not going to end up on many undergraduate reading lists. So I'm not really sure there is a way of, certainly not one way of making these connections. And I think, of course, to understand a text of any kind of intellectual complexity, you have to, in some sense or other, be approaching it philosophically. You have to be, in a loose sense of the word, I mean, you've got to be listening to its argumentative strategies, trying to figure out how the arguments are meant to work. And sometimes you'll notice that the arguments are not very good or don't work very well, or there seem to be gaps. And a historian writing a book about Gibbon or whatever is going to be attentive to argument, of course. But writing the history of philosophy, you do in the end have to make a choice about your audience and your intentions. This project, this book that I will end up writing, will be, again, much more of a work of intellectual history than it will be a work of the history of philosophy, as the history of philosophy is done in our part of the world, which is not very historically.
As we are coming to an end, what are your plans for future work?
Well, I'm very keen to have some time to develop this project on the people. I see myself writing a book which traces a story from Hobbes through to Rousseau and uses that as a way of clarifying and separating out two different ways of thinking about the people and popular sovereignty, one of which we could call Hobbesian, one of which we could call Rousseauian. Whether they understand it or not, today's populism is in many ways kind of Rousseauian in inspiration. It's, as I said, worth trying to get to grips with a rather different way of understanding what it means to talk about the people in politics and to understand the people as sovereign. And yes, in part that's a historical project, but as will be obvious from the things I've said, I think it's also something which has, I hope, something to say to some political issues that we're facing right now. So that's the thing I really want to get on to do. I also want to one day write this book on 18th century British philosophy. and try and, I suppose, bring together a number of things I've been working on over the years and try to present a very different kind of picture of that period, which is not just, you know, Locke, Berkeley, Hume, maybe Thomas, Reed, then Kant, but a much richer and broader and diverse and much more confusing, actually, world of philosophizing.
Well, thank you, James. That was absolutely fascinating. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And thank you, Elena, for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Look out for the next episodes on our social media feed. Goodbye for now.